The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
Why are short stories important?
I guess because the form itself is, for a certain kind of writer, and maybe I'm that kind of writer, a focus on the subtle shift or the dramatic shift, the epiphanic moment in an individual's life. The short story is the place where that can happen, I think most elegantly. And I think they are good vehicles for a certain kind of information about the world that, although novels share traits with, there are some small moments that can be focused on and framed most effectively in the shorter form.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Antonia Nelson about her latest collection of stories titled Funny Once. The first story in this collection is titled Literally. And just to give listeners an idea of your writing style and your wonderful sense of humor, I'd like you to just read the first page.
Okay. Literally. She's always late, the 16-year-old sobbed. She'd set up the ironing board and all its accessories like a shrine to housewifery. Heat shimmered in the air, had already slightly compromised the plastic of the spray bottle. Only Bonita could master the pleats of Suzanne's ghastly uniform skirt. Other girls did not care. Still others had punctual housekeepers or parents who ironed. Suze is so anal, her brother, Danny, noted from the table, where he and his father were studying their computer screens over breakfast, sharing news items and a bowl of pineapple. She takes 3 showers a day, which is more than some people take in a year. In the future, that will be illegal. Seriously, I skip showers so that our carbon footprint won't be so terrible. Do you know there's a second part to that expression, the retentive part? His father asked. It's amazing how comfortable people are tossing that around, anal, retentive. Everybody very casual with the psychology, so blasé about the butt. God damn it, the girl cried. Please, please, please. Also, Danny said, she exaggerates, constantly. Literally, his father said. Richard liked to make his son smile by using his favorite word incorrectly.
Just one example of a book full of small moments that are really fun and some that are dark. But it's interesting to me how you use dark humor and it doesn't seem dark.
Huh. Well, I was just thinking about or telling somebody that I got 100 pages into reading a book that's been, you know, recommended to me and has won prizes and what have you. And I realized I had not smiled, I had not been made to laugh once. And I put it down. I don't like to think of the world without having a fair amount of humor in it. And I guess I don't like books that don't at least sometimes make me smile. So it must be something just about my own sense of what writing ought to do.
I laughed many times while I was reading these stories, and I really appreciated that.
Well, thanks.
You have 2 children who are now grown, but when they were small, you still managed to publish many books. Your husband, Robert Boswell, is also a teacher and a fiction writer. How did family life and writing fit together for you in those days?
Well, the main part of that, I think, is that their father was also writing, and we shared a professorship when the children were young and just took turns, basically. I don't think he ever gets asked the question, how is it you manage to publish books and also raise children? I think women get asked that question pretty routinely, and I think his participation and his encouragement and his knowing how much it mattered to me to write and that it mattered to him to be there for the kids. I think that worked out really well for us in those days. We just took turns.
And it's so normal in your household. I think I read somewhere that your kids don't even read your books.
Yeah.
You hardly notice them.
My son has begun catching up with our work, which is kind of interesting. I've read a few of my stories to him. He's now 24 and, you know, asked for his feedback. And he's a good reader. I mean, a good critic. So it's interesting to have them be, you know, 24, 27 now. They're grown-ups, you know, and I think they recognize that in some of these stories they can find markers of their lives, our lives, events that have been transformed but are still recognizable. And I think some of that is uncomfortable for them, and other times I think it's pleasurable for them to hear or see themselves on the page. I know my niece was really happy to have herself quoted in one of my stories. she was flattered by that.
In the title story, Funny Once, Ben sets Phoebe's hair on fire, which is not really funny, but the way you write it, it is kind of funny, mainly because Phoebe has such a bad attitude about life that even the therapist she consults with won't take her on as a client. And even though having your hair set on fire is not funny, you managed to make it funny, and I really wondered if that came from something that happened in real life.
It didn't come from something in real life, but the thing that did come from real life is that I saw a woman wearing a scarf on her head, and it seemed to me that, you know, it was somebody I knew, and I didn't ask her about it. I didn't know her well, but it seemed to me that the story behind it was going to be just predictable and sad, and the sad predictability of that story, that is that she was probably having chemotherapy, made me envision some other story. And that's where the hair on fire came into it. Like, why would you have to cover your head? What image, what place could I get to that would be less predictable as a start point for having a scarf on the head? And an image came to me of a woman standing at her kitchen window and seeing her hair on fire, just, you know, and how would that have happened? How would that have turned out to be something that you saw yourself? Anyway, and I looked up, you know, scarring from flames, and I just decided it was not that serious a fire, so it could be treated a little more lightly.
Issues of mental health run through this collection, and many of your characters also have meaningful dreams. Does that come from reality? I know that I think a couple of your family members are in the mental health business. Do you get stories from them?
Yes, I do get stories from them. And my sister and my brother are therapists. And they were English majors before they were therapists. And I think there's something shared in the desire to know the story of people between writers and therapists. And my husband was a therapist before he was a writer. So there's a fair amount of this running around in our family. And I think it's interesting that when you are in the presence of a therapist, you are constructing a story in a confined space of time and attempting to situate the experience you're having in the larger way, the sort of chronic condition of your life, and then the presenting one. And that's precisely how short stories sort of move forward too, with the chronic situation of the character and then the presenting occasion for the story in question. So I think the two disciplines fit together really well, and it makes sense to me that I don't really want to write about characters who are writers. That seems to me a charged kind of not that much fun job for a character, but therapy is close enough to feel like a good place to locate characters who are not so different from myself.
Endless possibilities, it seems like.
Yeah.
For stories.
Yeah. My brother was once really unhappy that I had written, it was a novel, I had written a character who was not a very good therapist. He was disappointed that my therapist character wasn't a very good therapist. Or maybe he wanted to like the guy more, or maybe he wanted to respect him more. It was an interesting comment because I hadn't intended for the guy to be a bad therapist, but it was sort of irrelevant to my... To my mind, it wasn't really important whether he was a good or bad therapist. His job wasn't really what the novel was about. But was just funny to me. I think my brother was hoping that I was basing this character on him or something.
Mm. In your story, Winter in Yalta, Kara and her lifelong friend Rochelle, who has a small neurotic dog named Sylvia Plath, which is very funny, meet up in New York City to spend a few days together. And the story begins when Kara says this to a girl she's seated next to on the airplane. Quote, "Life, a series of lessons you don't want to learn," end quote, which is pretty brilliant considering what comes after in the story. And it just made me wonder, do you come up with a first line as you're starting into the story, or does the first line come later out of the story?
Oftentimes, I have a sense of a story. I have a sense of the thing I want to write about. It's very amorphous. And then phrases or images start adhering to, you know, a building miasma. And lines that resonate for me are frequently the first thing I come up with, but where they're placed is sort of up for grabs sometimes. The story, literally, I had the title of the story and I knew how I wanted to use it, but I didn't know when it was going to occur in the story. And this story, Winter in Yalta, I can't remember a first line or a sense of it, just that I knew I wanted to write a story that would have references to Chekhov. And so I used the character who sort of knows and is a reader as a way of, you know, highlighting that. And the person who's in her presence, the main point of view character, is not a reader. And so it was fun to me to be able to have literary lines falling around in the story from a character who reads, and then the character who doesn't read is the character to whom the story is happening.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Antonia Nelson about her story collection, Funny Once. If you'd like to listen to this program online, the audio is posted at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll hear another passage from the book and find out what Antonia Nelson wants people to know about her stories. Don't go away. How do you know when an image or an idea wants to become a story, for sure?
When it just won't go away, when it starts collecting material around it, when it has some sort of center of gravity that draws other stuff towards it. At the present moment, I'm working on a story that has a Mexican cemetery in the middle of it, and for whatever reason, that place is important to me as a signpost, as something that I'm going to write about or around, or it's going to be the locale. And a Mexican cemetery, or at least the ones in Las Cruces, New Mexico, are very different from traditional cemeteries. This one, anyway, it's full of plastic toys and flowers, and it's shrine-like and very gaudy, but kind of pretty in a way of a candy aisle or something. And that already is sort of interesting to me. And I know it's going to work in the story, but I'm not entirely sure how. I went and visited one while I was recently in Las Cruces. And the surprising thing to me is that at this cemetery, I mean, I encourage my students of writing to go to the places where they're writing about to make sure that the authentic detail, the telling details will come through. And in my mind, before I went to visit it, because I've been there before, I could get the pinwheels and flowers and stuffed animals and so on. But the sign outside the gate was a sign I would have had to witness to have in possession. And it said, no balloons. And then in parentheses, no globos. And I wouldn't have guessed, first of all, that balloons would be prohibited at this cemetery. Just why? But the fact that you have to make a sign that prohibits balloons at the cemetery that's got all manner of crazy objects in it just seemed great to me. Teddy bears are okay, but balloons, no.
Do you think those details are then the key to writing good stories?
Sometimes those details are key. Sometimes they are. Sometimes the small objects or small moments in stories turn out to be really fruitful. I feel like a detail can become an image, become something larger than just a descriptive piece of scenery if it's powerful enough. And some of that has to be witnessed properly. You can't just gloss over or not be paying attention. I guess what I like about being a writer is that, and hanging around with writers, is that those people pay attention and are watching the world a little bit differently than other people. I mean, there's a downside to that too, I guess, which is that if you're observing, you're not really enacting. A lot of the time, I think writers are on the outside scrutinizing or trying to figure things out rather than simply living in the moment. And that's a big downside. I mean, you're just trying to figure out what makes it all work, standing on the sidelines watching the dance instead of just being out there enthusiastically in the middle of it.
Well, this collection ends with a piece, an 11-part novella, and it's titled Three Wishes, which is about a family whose last name is Panik, spelled P-A-N-I-K. And I'd like you to read a short passage from that story.
Sure. The sections are titled, the novella is Three Wishes, and this section is titled A Clean Record. No one ever pronounced their last name correctly. Panik, the three siblings said in unison, as in panic. Panik, nodded the woman in scrubs, as if that explained everything. The group was gathered on the driveway of a yellow brick ranch-style house in Wichita, Kansas. The place did not look like a nursing home, which was one of the only advantages. It was a late summer dusk, and the woman in scrubs used her hand as a visor when she addressed the Panik father, the patriarch, owner of the name to begin with. How are we, Sam? She called. He blinked down at her furiously from his recliner. The chair sat like a throne in the back of his son's pickup truck, and the old man was duct-taped across the chest and lap into it. The expression on his face, furiously twitching lips, blazing eyes, suggested that his children had also duct-taped shut his mouth, which, for the record, they wouldn't have done. But he hadn't spoken to one of his living offspring since they'd announced their intentions. When the time had come to execute these plans, he'd grabbed the chair's arms with surprising strength, gone rigid as rigor mortis in its seat, wrapped his toes behind the perennially sprung footrest, and clung like a sloth. He had spoken the name of his long-dead son, Hamish. When he had been found, out wandering near the river, he had introduced the cops to his dead son. His living son, Hugh, owner of the pickup truck, wondered if this was where his own habit of addressing the dead came from. I thought he'd been drinking all day, Hugh's older sister had accused. And since when has drinking made him docile? Grab that side, Hugh had instructed his sisters wearily. And they wearily obeyed, the three of them carrying their father through his home of 50 years, wedging him briefly in the doorway while they took a breather, and then continuing out into the drive, his daughters on one side, Hugh on the other. He was not as heavy as they might have expected, but he was three times as enraged. That was the taxing part. I see you, Hugh called to Holly, the younger sister. I see her right through your head, old man. I see Hugh, replied Holly, gamely, but their father wouldn't be teased. The hippies next door looked up placidly as the family went by, nodding, smiling in a shared stupor. Just last week, they themselves had employed skateboards to move a sofa into the yard. They sat on that sofa now, waving, stoned and useless. Why were all the world's old sofas burnt orange and made of velveteen? Bye, Mr. Panik, they called. dude, they'd said to him when he felt an urge to spray the hose on their withered grass. He sprayed the water in memory of his neighbor, Hugh believed, a salute to the man who'd kept his yard immaculately green, his hedges trimmed square, his walkway edged, lawn maintenance a kind of religious or military fervor. This man who'd nonetheless died and left his house to his careless children, one of whose offspring was among these hippies and was letting whatever happened happen. What would old Mr. Roosevelt have thought today? Hugh paused on the drive, imagining their former neighbor, a man dead a dozen years now. Hugh often felt outside himself, watching his behavior as though through the eyes of some witness. Did it mean something that these witnesses were often dead? And if it were the dead who watched him, why wasn't it his mother he invoked today? She whose husband was being taken, via lazy boy litter, to the highly inappropriate bed of Hugh's truck. Or his brother Hamish, he whose ghost had been summoned by his father only an hour earlier, whose hallucinatory body was frequently appearing in Sam Panic's presence, derailing his days, leading to dangerous decisions. He'll jump, the older sister Hannah predicted. Hugh and Holly were accustomed to being bossed around by her, also to improvising, hence the duct tape. Across town they drove, parade speed, avoiding major thoroughfares. If we get stopped, Hannah said, it's me who'll be ticketed, just so you know. Poor you, Hugh said. He hadn't wanted to drive because he'd joined his father in having a few drinks this afternoon, their last together as roommates, and he was terrified of receiving a DUI. Holly, the youngest, not only was crying, but also had never learned to drive a stick, which left Hannah to take the wheel. What would they cite you for, though? I think it's illegal to ride in the back of a truck. People do it all the time. She whacked him with the backs of her fingers. What, were you absent the day everyone learned how lame that excuse is? Holly, in the middle, riding backward on her knees, had opened the sliding window between the cab and the bed, and she reached through to locate her father's bristly cheek, which she swatted awkwardly. Poor Papa, she murmured, sniffling. It's like we're kidnapping him. Don't mention that, Hugh said. He already has a whole storyline about kidnapping, something to do with Mom. That's why he locks himself in the bathroom. I feel so bad, Holly said. To Hugh, she still seemed stranded somewhere in her mid-20s, though if he was 39, merciless time dictated that she must be 35. Still, there she stayed stuck, a post-college drifter, skittish and lost, with terrible luck in love. She wasn't finished, a project still under construction, unconfident, acne on her chin. Hannah kept muttering sorry as she jammed the gear shift into her sister's leg, and Holly kept replying, it's okay. Why in hell would you prefer standard? Hannah demanded of Hugh. He shrugged. He liked shifting gears. He liked old-fashioned things. He was stubborn. Mostly, he enjoyed the sensation of neutral beneath his palm, the way the knob floated briefly in between options while the engine took a breath, and then he smoothly gripped and chose. None of this could be explained to Hannah. She continued to upgrade his life for him, bestowing upon him her second-hand laptop, gifting him with a laser measure on his last birthday, hauling both him and their father off for their annual flu shot. Hugh opened the passenger side window, crank handle, letting in more of the warm August evening. They might be making a tortured journey, but Wichita was peaceful enough tonight. Perhaps it was best that they'd been detained in their errand. Rush hour had ended, and the cicadas sawed on tiredly, the shade trees heavy with deep green leaves. Summer had had enough of itself, was just about to give up and let go. Riding three abreast in the front of Hugh's truck reminded the Panics of high school, as did the sound of the pavement beneath the spongy tires, the wind in their hair, dusk settling its melancholy self. Even the radio played the songs they'd known back when. Just imagine, Hannah said, just imagine this was the first time you heard this song. Tina Turner, what's love got to do with it? And somebody told you that in, 20 years or so, you'd be listening to it while your dad was riding in the grody bed of your truck, duct-taped into an easy chair. Would you believe that? Could anyone ever predict that was where we'd end up?
What do you want people to know about your stories or writing short stories?
Sometimes I think that the kind of wryness or darkness or the way that the characters are, to me, very realistic and very sympathetic, but I think sometimes come off to others as being maybe, I don't know, heartless is not quite right, but something along those lines. I guess I feel like mostly that the defenses of these characters, that they find themselves in situations where they'd rather make jokes or make drinks rather than talking seriously or getting over their problems, to me are endearing traits and ones that I have great sympathy for, but I think maybe readers who don't have that sympathy find the world a little, disturbing. I don't know what to make of that exactly, but I think it's probably just kind of the personality of reader and writer. I look when I'm reading for sensibility that in some way assures me my own sensibility is not alone out there. I think literature for me is about finding solace and companionship and intimacy.
And what do you say to creative writing students who have a burning desire to write short stories?
I say so much to them. I don't even know if I could begin to collapse that into something. I think prose writers are disposed one way or the other towards the long form, towards the novel, or towards the short story, and discovering which of those inclinations is your own is one of the things I wish I had figured out earlier. I think I am much more comfortable and excited when I'm working on a short story than to have to write a novel, or when the material that is a short story won't stick to that smaller space. So I guess one thing I would say to students, figure out which of these forms and don't try to do everything. Figure out if you're a long form or short form writer by nature.
If you had to go back to the beginning of your career, you might stick with short stories. Is that what you're saying?
I think I would have not felt, and I don't feel this is true, but I think I was sort of instructed to think the short story was the form you wrote, and then when you grew up, you'd write novels. It was sort of, the short story is like training wheels or braces or something. It's not, at that point in my life, I think I thought that way, that it was practice for writing something real and big. And I don't have that opinion of short stories at all now. I feel like they are, a lovely art form, and the more I study them as maker of them and appreciator of them, the happier I am about them. So I think that maybe is one of the things that I would, had I sort of figured this out a little earlier, I might be, I don't know how different it'd be, but.
You'd have 10 books of short stories instead of novels in between there.
I don't know if I would, but yeah, something would be different.
How many novels?
I have four novels.
Four novels and six books of stories. Is that right?
Seven, I think.
Antonia Nelson lives in New Mexico and Texas. Look for more information about her and her books at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, book reviews, poems, and book excerpts, as well as links to our podcast and our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.